And now for something completely different. I do hope you like our new science show theme. Three weeks before the 40th birthday, the warm-up. We go to WOM Adelaide for the comedy of climate change, the Ig Nobel Prizes, and rediscover the fossil beer can. We begin with the introduction of tobacco to Europe by Sir Walter Raleigh, nearly 400 years ago. This is how the phone call took place.
Hello, who's calling? Sir Walter Raleigh from the colonies. Yeah, put him on, will you? Hey, Harry. Pick up your extension, will you? It's Nutty Walt again. Hi, Walt, baby. Good hearing your voice. Things are fine here, Walt. The boatload of turkeys you sent us over here last November, they're still here, Walt. Yeah, they're walking all over London. See, that isn't a holiday over here, Walt. Just in America. Yeah, you got another winner for us, Walt, have you? Tobacco. What's tobacco, Walt? A leaf. You've got 80 tons of it. You bought 80 tons of leaves, Walt? Oh, you're beautiful, Walt. Walt, I don't know if you noticed last time. We have plenty of leaves over here in England. It's a special kind of leaf. It's some kind of food, is it, Walt? Not exactly. What do you do with the leaves, Walt? Are you saying snuff, Walt? And what's snuff? You take a pinch of tobacco and you stick it up your nose. And it makes you sneeze. I imagine it would, Walt, yeah. Goes over very big there, does it? Yeah, goldenrod seems to do it over here, Walt. Tobacco has other uses. You can chew it or stuff it in a pipe. Or you can put it in a little piece of paper. Roll it up. You don't have to tell me, Walt. You stick it in your ear, right? Between your lips. Okay, Walt. And then what are you doing with it?
You set fire to it, Walt.
Hey, you want to get on the intercom? I don't want the boys to miss this.
Bob Newhart, way back, with a thought experiment on tobacco. Now try the same thought experiment with coal. You go down underground, in the dark, and dig it up. Mining kills about 7,600 coal miners every year, but most are foreigners, so it may not matter. 80% of the energy from coal is wasted, and the mercury from burning it goes into the brains of about 60,000 babies every year in North America alone. And the clincher, Australian skinks and snakes hate coal, and so did the school kids at Aberfan in South Wales. And so to WOM Adelaide and the comedy of climate change.
My name is Robin Williams, and in 1971 I did my last Monty Python. And it was a raid on the Tate Gallery to put bras and knickers on all the rude statues. And one of the most delightful things was Graham Chapman dressed as the Queen Mother, standing with his moustache and a pipe, and people were wandering past in the street, almost collapsing with amazement at this incredible sight. He took absolutely no notice of that. Now, I interviewed him for the Science Show a few years later, and he was slightly unwell, so I was making him a cup of tea, and I said, "Do you take sugar?" He said, "No, I'm gay." That's exactly what my kids did. They laughed as well. It's got no logic to it. And the most amazing thing is that that juxtaposition of what makes funny, because we're about to talk about climate and comedy. The funny thing about comedy is you can't predict it necessarily. I have some colleagues here. Rod Quantock used to be in Travel. I think he used to take a dead chicken on a stick and go to various other people's posh receptions and lovely dinners. Would you please welcome Rod Quantock? Hannah Gadsby is a boxer, obviously. Really, she is a very enthusiastic one. Would you please welcome Hannah Gadsby? Andrew Denton has lots of rope, but never enough. And we miss you on telly. So we have a number of juxtapositions in climate where an awful lot of scientists are in this world conspiracy. And some of it's funny, some of it's terribly sad. Rod Quantock, you've done a number of presentations over the years about climate change. I want to ask you, how can comedy illuminate a subject as serious and complex as that?
Easily. Okay, next question. Look, just to give you a bit of my background, I probably am the only comedian in Australia, and I think I'm quite rare in the world, who actually devotes all of his comedy shows to issues around climate change, but particularly things like peak oil. But to get to that point takes an awful lot of work. And I spent a lot of time being a political comic, and I have the advantage that most of you don't have. I've got nothing to do during the day. I work for an hour or 2 hours at night, and the rest of the time is my own. And I spend that time reading what you don't have time to read. And I've had people come to me at the end of a show about politics, and people say to me, "I love coming to your shows every year because it means I don't have to read the newspapers for a year." So when I got involved in climate change, I applied for what used to be called a Keating Fellowship, and Howard changed that very quickly to an Australia Council Fellowship. And I applied for it because I was broke, a condition which lives with me constantly. And I thought, well, I've been around a while, I deserve some money. So I was about to turn 60 and I thought, well, what I'll do is I'll apply to them to do a project about the world from the day I was born. I was born in... And I just look at the world, where it came from and how it got to where it was contemporaneous with this application. So I did that, and I began in 1948, the Declaration of Human Rights, a division of Israel and Palestine, North and South Korea. Velcro was invented in 1948, the first hold and rolled off. You know, the roots of our contemporary world are there, and a lot of it's still festering today. But I'm not what you call a bright person, but I'm methodical. And I did it chronologically. And as I went through, I started to see things like the impact of chemicals in our environment. Now, I'd been aware of that, but as you march back through time and then push your way forward, these become more and more apparent. And then I hit the 1973 oil shock, when the world economy collapsed through lack of oil. So I got interested in peak oil. But as I got closer and closer to the day, I saw climate change looming and looming and looming larger in discussions. So I took that and I really knuckled down and I read everything there is to read about it. And I came to the conclusion that we're all going to die. Okay, now that's it. Now, I have a preconditioned attitude to apocalypse. By the time I was 10, I'd seen black and white footage of the Hiroshima bomb. I'd seen black and white footage of the Holocaust. I'd seen black and white footage of Japanese prisoners of war. I'd seen the worst that humanity could do to one another. And so it was very clear to me that climate change was something we weren't going to stop, because it's not in our nature to be intelligent and clever about these things. And then you throw in peak oil and you suddenly realise that the brick wall is approaching very, very quickly. So I thought, what do you do? And I thought, well, you tell people about it. That's what you do. So I did a show called Bugger the Polar Bears, This is Serious, because people were always thinking it's about polar bears. And I did shows called The People We Should Eat First. I actually have a list of people we should eat first. And when climate change really hits, I want you to remember that the person sitting in front of you is made of protein. Just keep that in mind. And as a general warning to all, try not to look delicious. I actually used to be 18 stone, but I'm trying to get less and less a source of food. But it's a lot of work to understand it. The basics are simple. CO2 is a greenhouse gas, and there's lots of it more in the atmosphere, and so we're heating up. But the consequences, the flow-ons, the shift changes in the state of our environment that can happen very, very suddenly, those sorts of things you've really got to study. And I got to a point where I thought, it's all over. And I thought, well, you're a comedian, what would you know? So I rang a professor at Melbourne University, one who shared in the Nobel Prize for the IPCC report, and said, can I come and have a coffee with you? And I said, we're all going to die, aren't we? And he said, yeah, we are. And I spoke for a few more, and in the end, I rang Robin Williams, because I was going to be in Sydney. I thought, he's the man who speaks to all the scientists. I'll save myself a lot of coffees that I can't afford and go and talk to him. So I went to him and I said, look, are we all going to die? And he said, yes. So that's where I got to. And then turning that into comedy was very difficult. It took me approximately 2 years to be able to go on and do a two-hour show about climate change. But as I go on and I see that my rather naive hopes, I suppose, of telling people here's the problem and people will respond, clearly hasn't worked. So I'm now in a position where I'll keep doing the comedy, but I don't have terribly much confidence at all.
What I want to know, Rod... give me two names of who you would eat first.
Well, Tony Abbott was now...
He's too chewy.
I know, he's too thin. And I mentioned this to an audience, and a woman put her hand up and said, stock. Boil him down for stock. Because that's right, isn't it? That's what you do. You know, Gina Reinhardt, I've put out a...
No, yes. Please.
I put out a recipe book called How to Feed a Family of Four to a Family of Eight. But anyway, so anything else?
All right. Hannah, same question.
Assuming I'm not here because I'm an expert on climate change, as is Rod, I do have all day to myself, but I don't put it to use. A lot of naps, which I think is an energy-saving technique. I think I'm doing my bit. I'm here because I've used comedy to make unpopular ideas palatable. In the early days, one of those was making homosexuality palatable in Tasmania.
So that worked.
It worked, yeah. I take all the credit. When I first started doing comedy, I realised comedians are the underdogs. And then I saw that most of the comedians, and especially the successful ones, are white, middle-class, heterosexual men who went to private school. I love it when they get angry. They're like the canaries. You know the world's screwed if they're angry. And... what I came to learn very quickly is that I was not only up against it in life, I was up against it in comedy. I'm not everyone's picture of what a comedian should be. I don't hold true to most of the cliches of what I am as a bigly Tasmanian lesbian with mental health issues. And that's an uphill struggle in life and great for comedy. But I don't hold true to any of the cliches. Tasmanians are simple. Lesbians are angry and don't have a sense of humour. Women are moody and irrational and emotional and can multitask. None of these things apply to me. And of course, mental health being something that has come into the public consciousness, but certainly when I was first talking about it, it was still a shock that comedians were sad. Cat's out of the bag now. I've lost the element of surprise. But a lot of my work isn't done at these lovely festivals where you're instantly on my sides. I do clubs and pubs, I do regional tours, and I will follow comedians who make homophobic, sexist, racist remarks. And I cannot be angry to an audience who've just laughed at that. Because A, they're not going to listen to me, they're not going to like me, and they're not going to laugh at me. And if someone's not laughing, they're not listening. So part of what I think I'm really good at is making people listen to things they normally find uncomfortable. And one of my favourite things that has happened to me in my career is I was in Tasmania once and this bloke came up to me, and he's not my demographic. He'd look at a lot of you and beat a lot of you up. You know, that kind of guy. So like, yeah. He came up to me and I felt threatened. You know, I felt physically threatened. I'm like, oh no. And he just came up to me, "You're that piss funny lesbian." I'm like, I hope. Because I don't want to disappoint you. And then he said, "That stuff you do about depression, spot on, good on you, mate." And I'm like, I don't know what I've done. Like, it was just a really lovely moment to think that someone like that has looked at someone like me and listened. And I think that's what comedy can do in a situation like this, take an unpopular and, a very miserable topic and make a conversation that is a little bit enjoyable other than just, "We're all going to die." It's, "We're all going to die."
Yeah, it is funny. Thank you. It's actually incredible how serious this bunch were when we were briefing for an hour and a half. How do you do this in front of an audience, an unforgiving audience like you and us? In the middle of that, Paul Willis turned up with his son Chester, and they had just been to Argentina, to a cathedral. And they walked in and there was this wonderful statue of the Madonna and Jesus. And Chester, who's 8, said, "Look, Dad, there's Brian." It was too. There's Andrew. Same question.
Well, look, my favourite definition of comedy is Mel Brooks, who said that tragedy is when I cup my finger, comedy is when you walk into an open sewer and die. And I think it's important to frame this conversation with that. I have, for some years now, been attempting to form a group of what I refer to as fundamentalist moderates. And our aim is to travel the world and slaughter anyone that won't see both sides of the argument. Because it's hard not to see people of good intent and great intellect and hard work, such as scientists who are working on this, traduced in the way they are, to hear them referred to as millionaires, although I prefer John Stewart's description of them as thousandaires, and to see the scientific method being so thoroughly rubbished and disrespected. And it's hard not to respond to that with some degree of anger or some degree of sarcastic humour. Part of me tends to think that those who believe that the scientific method that has led us to understand global warming is ridiculous should have their electricity and planes and cars taken away, because clearly they don't work either. I sometimes think that Andrew Bolt should be given a holiday home on the shores of Vanuatu for a year from which to write his articles, just to get him a little closer to the subject. But then I've realised that the getting angry is kind of a waste of energy. It's not useful energy, and energy is the source of what we're talking about here, and that the energy we should be expending around that vast group of people in the middle who are uncertain and who are looking for cues about what to think and how to act. And it's a difficult subject to get your head around because it's distant and it's abstract and it's existential. It's inviting people, as Rod and Hannah have reminded us, to attend their own funeral procession. So, where does comedy sit in this mix? I think we tend to overstate the effectiveness of satire quite often. I thought the reaction to the Charlie Hebdo attacks, where some people posited that the terrorists only killed these people because they were so terrified of them, was ridiculously and patently nonsense. I mean, these terrorists acted with such brazen impunity. Terrified was what they were not. And I'm often reminded of Peter Cook's response when he set up the Establishment Club in London, which was a satirical club, and Peter Cook was one of the finest comic minds we've ever produced. And he was asked, "What difference do you think this is going to make to British politics?" And he said, "Well, I think it will affect British politics in the same way as German cabaret unseated Hitler." Mm-hmm. And I think we can overstate the value of satire and its impact greatly. However, I do think comedy, when done in a certain way, has its place. And as evidence of this, those of you that saw John Oliver do that piece where he got 97 climate scientists to debate three climate deniers to visually represent the actual statistics of the debate was a very effective piece of comedy, because even if you were on the other side of the argument, you could sure as hell understand what he was going to say. Comedy, when it's done well, shows people ways of thinking, ways of organising their arguments, ways of critically analysing the world. It's why people like Bill Hicks and George Carlin and Lenny Bruce are still remembered and quoted and watched and listened to and read today, because they didn't just tell jokes, they put together an argument and they used comedy to make it stick. As Hannah said, if people are laughing at you, they're listening. And people on both sides of the divide, left and right, have a universal desire to laugh and to be made laugh. However, I think the issue is, if comedy is just preaching to the choir, as we are today, hallelujah, then I think it is limited. And the question to me is, how does comedy become useful? How does it speak across the gap? How does it speak to the elephant in the room? I keep hearing climate change referred to as the elephant in the room. Well, actually, it's not the elephant in the room. It is the room. It is the room we're in. There is no other room. So how do we speak across the gap? And how do we reach that vast group of people in the middle who are looking at ways to act? So my belief is that the way to do that is to put humour together with humanity.
Hannah, were you about to use your microphone?
No, I just, it's not a shape I'm used to. So.
Question.
We all want to live in a world, as George W. Bush said, where man and fish can live together peacefully. And the question to me is, what is it? Let's reach beyond the things that we dislike about our opponents and that they hate about us. And what is it that we have in common? One of the greatest primal drivers of civilization has been the desire to protect the next generation. Even those who you most despise on the other side would not argue with the thought of a clean planet would be nice, food security would be good, wars not based on immigration would be excellent, and a decent planet for our children would be great. So if we can agree on those things, and it's surely possible to do that, then how do we move from there? And this is the ultimate human problem. This is human-made, and I believe our response to it needs to be based in humanity, emotion, as Hannah said, because when people respond with their hearts, a lot of the climate change argument is about intellect. It's about graphs and information and statistics, and they are shocking and sobering. But if you want people to act, you've got to speak to their heart. So, for example, the demonisation of scientists. I think it would be a very worthwhile thing as a response to what's been talked about, as the entire scientific method has been trashed and their motives have been questioned, to actually go and talk to these people as human beings and talk to them not just about the work they've done and why they do it and the passion they feel about it, but about what their doubts are as well. And I think it would be worthwhile and useful to accept the fact that the people who are most passionately committed on both sides of this argument, the activists and the denialists and those who would lie about it, perhaps their motives and passions come from a similar place, which is the incredible fear and the almost incomprehensible task of trying to face up to an existential threat. And in George Marshall's book, one of the interesting things he does is he goes to speak to Christian fundamentalists, and he does this because he wants to know how religions, who have been the most effective communicators and instigators of mass communal action, how they've done it. And a man he goes to speak to is Joel Hunter at the Northland Church, who says, one of the most important things we do is we have a process whereby we accept that there is doubt and uncertainty and there is backsliding in this process, and we encourage people to express it and we acknowledge it. And I think it would be worthwhile for us in this conversation, rather than simply demonising, and the tactics are deplorable and mendacity needs to be called out where it is, but I think it would be a more worthwhile exercise, rather than just launching into that pitch battle, to actually try and get a broader understanding as to why these people think the way they do. Because it's not simply about they hate us. And I suspect that their fears and their desires for the planet are not that dissimilar to ours. But when somebody is connected emotionally, they can transcend ideology. And that's the broader point I'm trying to make today, which is when we get locked into ideology, we don't move forward.
Andrew Denton with Hannah Gadsby and Rod Quantock at WOMAD Adelaide.